Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. Here with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen, and shortly back from Albania, and our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson will be joining us throughout the show. But first up, while there is plenty to discuss on the international front, at home, in the same week the Canberra men's A-League team was delayed a year, the Newcastle Jets have confirmed Maverick Sports Partners as the club's new ownership group. The consortium take control of the Jets from a group of fellow A-League clubs that has funded the club since 2021. With Perth Glory safely in the hands of new owners, it looks like the final piece of the A-League club ownership puzzle is in place. And while he's synonymous with the Central Coast Mariners and is rightly proud of their high-flying current status, there's no one more entitled to comment on the Jets than their former CEO and general manager of football, Laurie McKenna, who tipped in $365,000 of his own money to keep the club afloat during COVID. So we'll ask Laurie what he makes of the new ownership group and whether this is finally the change of fortune the Hunters flagship football club needs. Then the Euros, as we said, are off and running with plenty of storylines from the usual suspects, but are we seeing the dying of the light from Croatia as the mighty Luka Modric turns 39 and inevitably faces his own football mortality after being picked to pieces at various stages of the game by Spain, but also showing that they still have some chops? The Vetrini will need to quickly regroup against an Albanian side who took it to Italy in the opening round and are on the rise. To talk about it all, we'll be joined by editor-in-chief of the Croatian website Telesport and an independent football writer for The Guardian, our good friend Alexander Holliger. Edge, always great when the big tournaments are on, but we've got to keep an eye on our own backyard as well.
Yeah, we do. And Newcastle Jets, everyone's been just hoping that the new ownership group is going to step up and deliver the potential that club has. I think no one better than Laurie McKenna to give us some insight. He is obviously up there for 4 or 5 years as their CEO. And people forget the last time the Jets performed on the field in the men's side of the competition, at least, was when Laurie was running the club. Who can forget that big grand final against Melbourne Victory up in Newcastle, Rob? I think 30,000 people went to that game.
No, it's an absolute ripper. And Derek, before we welcome Willem back from his European adventures, speaking of European adventures, after 8 years, are you used to getting up at weird hours to watch big matches from the other side of the world?
I think you ever get used to it, Rob. You do kind of feel jet lagged in these tournaments, don't you? As you get up in the wee hours, or even, you know, probably that England game where you could get up and catch some of the second half for me was pretty good. But yeah, obviously a mixed bag with Scotland going down to the host, but already some fantastic games and narratives happening in the tournament.
Absolutely. And Willem, you're in Germany right now getting ready to go to your first game. But Albania, mate, did you feel like you were sort of on the bandwagon when they were playing Italy? You know, we're not exactly saying you're part Albanian because you would have been happy that the Dutch ended up getting out of jail. But
No, Rob, good to be back. Thanks for the time off and nice to parachute back in during a major tournament, no better time. Look, I feel more Dutch at the moment than I do Albanian, but we were up the elbows, as we were saying, and they put one right on the chin of your Italian boys pretty early on. But as they say, the goal came a little bit too early, but no, a fantastic country. Felt like a little bit of a secret being there. Not sure that'll be the case in 5 years, but time well spent. And now in Dusseldorf, where I greet you from, we've got Scotland versus Switzerland in Cologne in a couple of days, which is the first game I'm fortunate enough to attend. But yeah, plenty to pick through as we get there. And we will start with those Scots. Germany kicked off their home Euros with a bang. They had Scotland at 10 men and 3-0 down at halftime, and ultimately won 5-1 before 69,000 in Munich. Germany's youngsters did the damage early with Florian Wirtz and Jamal Musiala first on the score sheet. And the goal difference that they racked up does put them in the box seat to progress in top spot, with Switzerland and Hungary to come.
It's a glorious turn by Gundogan, and this is Kai Havertz. Musiala! 2-0 to Germany! The foot is on the throat now.
Italy, the Netherlands, and England all also enjoyed wins across the first 3 days of competition. So the top seeds all off to a good start. Spain's 3-0 win over Croatia. You could say that that was two top seeds going at it, Rob, and a pretty emphatic result out the back end of it. We'll speak to Alexander Holliger later. And we'll also pick through England and Scotland. Steve Clark might be wise to tune into that. But what have your takeaways been, Rob, from the first couple of days of competition? Where do you want to take it?
Well, I was disappointed, obviously, like everyone who's not German, to see Scotland get bashed up in that that opening game. I mean, a red card before halftime against a home side that has the home crowd baying for blood is always going to be hard to come back from in the second half, and the Scots just weren't capable of regrouping. The post-mortems in the podcasts and the press have been pretty brutal. I know, Derek, you and I listen to The Guardian Football Weekly, and Barry Glendinning is not famous for pulling his punches, and he just, speaking of landing one on the chin, he went for the left-right combo and finished with a headbutt.
Look, Scotland came in with hope rather than expectation. Clearly, the idea of being in the opening game was a certain amount of romance to that, but obviously, you know, it was a pretty evident very quickly that Scotland were second rate compared to Germany. That terrible tackle pretty much summed up the first half performance. I don't think anyone, including the player himself, had any arguments with that. It was an awful challenge, and thankfully the player is okay. But look, Germany's goals were all excellent. I love it when goals are pinging into top corner, you know, just brilliant finishes, all of them. And I think Germany would take a lot of confidence from that. That you look at the England result, and there's a lot of people saying, oh, they're playing their way into the tournament. I'd say, nah, just go and destroy the opposition in the first game. That's the way you get into the tournament. So well done, Germany. And Scotland now will face that do or die next game.
Had some remnants of 2010, the opener against the Socceroos at the World Cup Edge, which I know you were at for Germany. They've spent the last 18 months being told they're no good under Julian Nagelsmann, but none of that really matters when you roll out on opening night and stick five in the net.
German national teams are renowned for heading into tournaments where they're considered to be undermanned, inexperienced, and potentially off the pace. And they're renowned for proving everybody wrong. And they'd have to go into... Well, I mean, they're now... Monty used to go through as the top seeded out of their group, you would think, after that big win. And who knows? This could be their home European championship. They are a phenomenal, phenomenal football nation, aren't they? I mean, whatever you think about the standard of the Bundesliga in the pecking order of international or European leagues, the German national team, they get the job done time and time again.
I most certainly do. Plenty more Euros to come throughout this program and also stoppage time later in the week. Before we do, welcome in Laurie McKinnon. We'll punch through a few of these details around the Newcastle Jets. Maverick Sport Partners are to take over pending APL and Football Australia approval. They're led by former Western United CEO Maurice Bassetto, and the consortium also sees a 25% stake held by former West Tigers officials Lee Hadjipantelis and Justin Pascoe. That pair having left the NRL club at the end of last year. Now, Rob, question without notice. What can you tell us about that pair and the struggles that they faced with the West Tigers and the state of that NRL club for those who are not au fait with that code?
Yeah, so the West Tigers, for those of, well, I'd imagine some of our Southern State listeners and international listeners, are a merged club in the National Rugby League from the Western Suburbs Magpies and the Balmain Tigers. They've had a couple of periods of success, winning grand finals, but as many periods where they are ripped apart by internecine warfare, and the two names you mentioned, Lee Hadjipantelis in particular, has been right in the middle of knowing what it takes to bring a fractured club together, not always successfully. So it feels like these people have got experience at the top level, enough experience if they've got the passion for football as much as they do for rugby league to rebuild a club that's always threatened to see. You know, they've had one championship win, a couple of second place premiership runs, but it feels like they're the right people with the right credentials behind them to rebuild the Jets, and a pedigree of sport in the Hunter that a club like that deserves.
Heading over to the UK, former Arsenal and Everton striker Kevin Campbell has passed away, aged just 54 after a short illness. He scored 59 goals in 224 games for the Gunners, winning the Premier League, FA Cup and a couple of other honours. And also remembered very fondly at Everton, a club where he was captain at one point. On his arrival, his 9 goals in 5 games saved the club from relegation in 1999. He rounded out his career at Cardiff City in 2007, Derek, and went on to become a much-loved pundit right up until his untimely passing. He has been remembered very fondly, and this is as much as an Arsenal story as any other.
Yeah, it was a shock when we saw this, and it is an Arsenal story. I think Kevin, by his own admission, will tell you that Arsenal was his first love and his first club. Ian Wright, his strike partner from back in the day, was very emotional on the ITV coverage this week, reflecting on his pal. I went and checked, and he was actually on the pitch for my first ever Arsenal game, playing up front with Ian Wright. And they were quite the duo back in the early 90s. This was before the Bergkamps and other players emerged, so very much that last generation of Arsenal before the Wenger era. So yeah, look, all everyone has said was what a lovely guy he is, how much time he had for everyone that he came into contact with. And he was a great player too, like great goal scorer, had a fantastic time at Nottingham Forest, formed a great partnership with your Dutch compatriot Pierre Van Hooydonk. I think Van Hooydonk struck when Campbell was sold to Turkey. Such was the feeling for this player. And yeah, you called it. He scored 9 goals for Everton as they, for not the first time, saved their Premier League future in the dying games of a season. So yeah, a real shock. Super Kevin Campbell. I remember him very well. And yeah, just all our wishes with his family at what must be a sad time.
Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army. Drawbridge almost up on the Paris Olympics, but Edge has been working feverishly on that 2026 World Cup program. So head to gjtravel.com.au and sign up to the mailing list and be among the first to know as that operation progresses. What did you make of the Socceroos? Briefly, Edge, it's a little while ago as we record, but they did complete the second round of World Cup qualifying without a hitch, 5-0 over Palestine in Perth, which means through their 6 games, they took all 18 points, 22 goals scored, none conceded. It was a brace for Cassini Yenge, a first home national team goal for Adam Taggart, and the first of a few from Nestori Irankunda, as promised by the young man himself.
Well, I think you'd have to rate the Socceroos' first phases of World Cup qualification a 9 out of 10 for me. Graham's been able to blood an enormous amount of young talent. He's been able to keep these experienced players in the fold and ticking them over. He's been able to look after some players with some breaks. It's been a fabulous, first period of qualification. And although we didn't score enough ranking points to be popped into pot one of the next phase of qualifying, the fact that we're in pot two means we are likely to get two more challenging opponents in the second phase of qualification. We have to go into that second phase with an enormous amount of confidence. The Socceroos have been fantastic on the road, impeccable preparation. They have to be applauded. These days, Rob, the Socceroos are often in the shadow of the Matildas. So, the Matildas off to the Olympic Games. There's a lot of focus on their development and their sort of progress as they build up to Olympic Games. But the Socceroos, well done to Graham Arnold. They just keep on keeping on, and I'm terribly excited about some of the younger players that Graham's found and given time to. And I think it's all bright, and I'm looking forward to the next phase of qualification, whoever it is we play.
Yeah, and look, just watching the Euros, just very briefly, the fact that we were able to get over the Danish side, who are competitive against the world's best on the European stage to get out of that group suggests to me that, sometimes we act as if the Socceroos are overachieving when they do these sorts of things, and we're and we're surprised. But it feels like, you know, with some of that young talent coming through and you know, the experience of what's going to be hopefully six World Cups in a row, that, you know, we should start to stretch our ambitions a bit more beyond just getting out of the group stages. You know, the next one has to be winner a knockout match and just see how far we can penetrate into a World Cup tournament.
Certainly is. I'm looking forward to it big time. Can't wait until the I think the when's the draw, Willem? I think it's about the 2 weeks' time before we find out who our five opponents in the next group of six the qualification is going to be.
Yep, and those matches will commence from September, just as we close. Rob, 50 years this week since the Socceroos took part at the 74 World Cup finals in West Germany. And the game, as we speak about ad nauseum, doesn't always treat its history well, but I think that group and that story are very well remembered and treated with the respect and the remembrance and the recognition that they thoroughly deserve.
Yeah, no, well done, well said. Agree 100%, mate. Okay, time to have a chat to Laurie McKenna. Laurie's got a decorated history at the Central Coast Mariners, but also with the Newcastle Jets, played an active part during the pandemic in keeping the club alive. He was the general manager of football and CEO and a good friend of Box to Box, a great mate of View Edge. And it'd just be fascinating to hear what he's got to say, whether he, you know, franks the comments that I made about the people from the Maverick Sports Group taking over and whether they're the right people to take the club to a new era or whether he's got concerns. Stick around, you'll hear that all next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
The future of the Newcastle Jets have been an uneasy topic in Australian football for some time and seemed to accelerate towards crisis point in March when APL Chairman Stephen Conroy stated they were not in a position to underwrite the club any further. 2 months on, the interminable wait for those new owners has closed with Maverick Sports Partners to sustain the Jets into a new era. Nobody knows how to keep clubs alive in the region like former Jets CEO Laurie McKenna. It's a pleasure to have him back on the program. Laurie, welcome back to Box to Box.
No, thanks for inviting me on for a chat.
The issue of the Jets ownership has really dragged on and on, but the important part is for now it's resolved, pending Football Australia and the APL's regulatory processes. So would it be fair to say you met the news with a degree of relief or any other sort of overriding emotions?
Yeah, because going back a few months ago when it was said that if nobody comes to the party now, the possibility of the club actually being withdrawn from the A-League for this season, and nobody wants to see that, especially with all the negative press we've been getting. So when I heard the Maverick Sports Group had come in and taken on the club, like, nobody knows much about the deal, which I suppose it's nobody else's business. But for them to come in, though, I think just reading social media and speaking to a lot of people in Newcastle that I know during my time there, like, it was like a relief. I wouldn't say it was dancing in the street stuff, but it was a big relief to know that somebody's actually come in and they can start building for next season now. That's the big thing, that at least Robbie Stanton, the coach, knows. Obviously, he would have met with the new owners and obviously got a budget, hopefully put together for him, so he knows where he stands at the moment. Because I know a few players have left the club, and it's a big thing for him to know what he's got to spend to retain those players.
Laurie, the first question I've got for you is, over the past 3 years, the obviously rival clubs have owned Newcastle Jets. They've been starved of capital and resources. That's been well documented. How do you assess, you will know because you were the last CEO that had sustained success with the Jets. What's your opinion of how the community in Newcastle feel about the Newcastle Jets at the moment? And is there any sort of repair work that this Maverick Sports Group ownership group needs to undertake with the community?
All right, the first bit of the question, I honestly don't think they were starved of funds, in my opinion. I just knew some numbers that were flying about. So I know a lot of the fans said that, and I know that was the message for the club because they weren't successful. In my opinion, they were reasonably well-resourced, and they just never did well. That's my own personal opinion. Moving forward, I think the new group come in, I hear all this stuff, they're going to get back into the community, they're going to be back. That's what they said over the last 3 years. And if they think getting into the community the way it does, they're kidding themselves. And again, that's my opinion, being there for 5 years, when we got the membership base up to 11,600 members, because we became a community club. We did work with football in Northern New South Wales. We worked with individual clubs. We became a community club, a real community club, and it showed because people engaged with us and supported the club, and we had a great membership base, the most it's ever had. So it can definitely, the support's there. They need to get on side with Northern New South Wales football, because there were a couple of games near the end of the season there where the Jets were kicking off, and all the NPL games were getting played on the Saturday night at the same time. You know, that happened a few times and I was there as well. That has to be sorted out, because that's the audience who come to watch the games, and they aspire to be playing with the Jets. So football, Northern New South Wales and the club have to sit down and work out a schedule where the Jets aren't playing at the same time as the NPL. That's a basic thing that has to be sorted as well, in my opinion.
And what did you think of the announcement, Laurie? I must admit, if I was a Jets fan, and I like the Jets, I think everybody's got a soft spot for the Newcastle Jets because of their rich history, and it's such a strong footballing region of Australia. But there was no A-League representative at the announcement, and there was... And Maurice Bozzetto, who I understand is a figurehead of a consortium, there was no disclosure as who owns the club. And the only message from Maurice Bozzetto was that for the Jets to be sustainable and successful, it needed community support. I was left scratching my head thinking that that type of announcement didn't really warm the cockles of my heart. And I imagine Newcastle Jets fans are thinking, is this going to be a repeat of years gone by? What did you think of that?
No, much the same as you're thinking. It was, yeah, they made the announcement on TV, the few players, ex-players there. I know they made Jason Hoffman's now going to be working within the club, which is a great move. Hoff's been a great servant to the club. But it was very low-key, and maybe they don't want the bells and whistles to go along with it, but in my opinion, they need to make a statement soon, as in signing some players to actually start showing that they're actually going to do the job and not just talk, come in and do what they've done over the last few years and look as though they're just stalled. They need to come in and start ticking off some boxes now. Some new players, new signings from other clubs, maybe get a named player in. And they need to take a page out of the Mariners book. You don't need to spend a huge fortune to be successful. You have to start building it. And now this is the time to start building it. Give Robbie Stanton some confidence in what he's going to get as a squad, and make some announcements, because it's been very, very quiet. As you said, it was a very low-key announcement. I would be jumping, if I was FFA at the moment, not FFA, APL, I'd be doing somersaults that they've got a buyer, or a buyer that's got to pass the fit and proper person test to come and take the club. But reading between the lines now, they're going on as though they're the owners of the club. So have they been approved? The leaders, the APL, have to come out and make a statement soon as well, because the fans are all sitting back wanting to know who the Maverick Group is. Are they going to invest in the club? And it's not all about investing millions and millions of dollars to get a team. It's not about that. It's about building the squad, building the staff, and slowly, they're not going to win the grand final next year, the year after, but they have to start building now for the future, and the future growth of the team again, and the club, because since COVID came in and that, and we left over the last 3 years, it's been a sad sight. Sadly, you don't want to say that, but that's just the truth. You know, they've been struggling away at the bottom of the league, and the crowds have been very low, so they need to build that. And the supporters are there; they just need something to get their two hands round about and say, "This is my club. I'm passionate about my club again, because the club's given back to us."
It certainly has. So what do we know about Mavry Sports Partners? Well, Maurice Bozzetto, he was the CEO and director of the Western Melbourne Group, the owners of Western United between 2019 and 2020. He's also a former KPMG partner and businessman from Melbourne. He's the public face of the consortium. The only other bit of information, which is interesting, but it leaves a lot of other questions, is that it's been disclosed by the Sydney Morning Herald, and we assume that that reporting is correct, that former West Tigers NRL board members Justin Pascoe and Lee Hadjipantelis have a 25% stake in the ownership group. There is commentary about how they ran the West Tigers in the NRL. That's interesting to say the least, but that's about all we know of the ownership group at the moment. We might just leave that there for the moment. I'll ask you, what does it mean for the A-League that the Jets have new owners? You know, will the APL management be happy about this? And do you think that the Jets have a promising future?
Yeah, I've always been a huge supporter of what the club could bring. You know, they've got a huge region. They've got over 60,000 registered players. You know, they go right up to the border, the Queensland. So your Coffs Harbour, Port Macquarie, these areas, the big football areas as well, and they get players through their academy squads from there. So they've got a huge market to tap into. It's actually getting people and resources out there to get these people engaged again, because people want to feel as though they're part of it. They just don't want to hear say, saying, oh, yeah, we'll look after regional areas and that's it. You have to do a bit more than that. But the club, in my opinion, has got a huge, huge future if it engages its fans properly and treats them with respect. Because for many, many years, the fans have hung on supporting the club. Yeah, and some of them have voiced their opinions. They're not happy because lack of this or lack of that, lack of money, lack of finances. But these new owners deserve to be given the chance. They should come in and get behind them. These guys are putting up their hard-earned money. They never needed to. They could have invested in other clubs, but they've invested in the Jets. So the fans, in my opinion, have to give them a chance and get behind them and show them what good supporters the Jets fans had. Because we had the first regional grand final. I know the Mariners had the grand final a few weeks ago, and it was huge for the area and the town. But going back when we played Victory when I was the CEO and we had 30,000 people at that game, it was absolutely massive, you know. In the area, they won the grand final in 2008 when they beat the Mariners when I was the coach, you know. And in my 5 years at Newcastle Jets as the CEO, I never got over it. I started twitching every time somebody mentioned it. So we had a good bit of banter about that. But no, I think it's a huge chance. The Maverick Group's saw the potential, and nobody's announcing how much they bought the club for or how much of the debts they've taken over. That's confidential, I suppose. And it's just about the team moving forward, the club moving forward, the fans engaging, but the club engaging with the fans is a big thing for me.
Well, let's hope that the new owners will disclose who they are firstly and help build a narrative around the club that the fans can buy into, and we see packed houses in Newcastle and they climb up the ladder. Laurie, just before I hand back to Willem, now with your Central Coast Mariners hat on, I just want to ask you about what was just a magic few months in the history of that club, a club that you coached to a championship, but you were as much a fan as anybody else over the last few months. You were over in Muscat in Oman to see them lift the AFC Cup trophy, and then you scurried back home to see them get the job done in Gosford as well. What can you share with us about just your own personal ride over the last couple of months, re-engaging with the Mariners as one of their biggest fans, and just how proud of you of the little club that's now a little club making big inroads.
I think over the last 2 years, I think Monty started it. And when he left at the end of last season, and Matt Jackson come in. he lost the first four games, and to come back for that is one big tick for me. You know, everybody wrote him off, me included. I'm going, who's this English guy? I didn't know much about him. And then they just slowly started plodding away. And even in the games where they weren't great, they were getting results. You know, they just ground out results. They were very hard to beat. They had that belief in each other that they could break teams down. And you look at that grand final against Victory, but Victory scored late in the second half and they just kept plugging away. And when they got that, the first goal, they were never going to be another winner. You know, they were, that was it. The momentum changed. Tony Popovich had made his subs. He'd taken off his strikers. There were no way Victory were coming back for that. And to go on and win 3-1, the first half was quite cagey, as a lot of grand finals are. But in the second half, it was just a great spectacle. It was great for the Central Coast. And obviously, I went on to become the mayor and stuff up here. And it's, my job was to sell the Central Coast. But the Mariners over the last couple of years have certainly helped do that. And for the region up here, it's just been great. It's been tremendous. And it's just great watching a lot of these non-football people actually support our football, you know, not just rugby league. You get sick getting told, oh, Central Coast of rugby league town. Well, it's not now. It's the Mariners have done more for the coast in the last 19 years than I think anybody else has done for the coast, in my opinion.
Laurie, awesome to chat. The Mariners, yeah, what a story. And they are, as much as any club in Australian sport, a credit to those who have sustained them over the journey, and you've been central to that. So congratulations, although you're not directly involved anymore. And as for the Jets, good to chat. I think we all waited for so long for that announcement, but having heard the sort of tone of your voice and how you and Edge have picked through the issues, still plenty to play out. So we'll check back in with you as time rolls on. Laurie, fantastic to chat.
Cheers, boys.
Stick around on the other side. Rob and Derek will be back. It is major tournament time with the Euros on, so they'll be joined by one of our occasional, he's a good mate, but he comes on from time to time. It'll be Alexander Holliger to chat about the troubles at the minute facing Croatia.
It's Chemist Warehouse time, and apart from all of the great deals you get at Woo-hoo. Chemist Warehouse, it's correct, woohoo, it's always exciting when we talk Chemist Warehouse, but also Chemist Warehouse, anyone who knows them well, is I have done for many, many years. They are also great members of the community. And right now, when you purchase any Head & Shoulders or Gillette product at Chemist Warehouse, P&G, that's Procter & Gamble, will donate 25 cents to the Gotcha for Life Foundation to improve men's mental health. Now, Michael, you have a lot to do with football, and you know, sometimes it's easy to pay lip service to these things, but it's a critical message that we all need to talk about more often. And this is a great campaign.
Certainly is, absolutely. Men's mental health is as important as every other sort of issue of modern society, and great to see Chemist Warehouse doing their bit. Head & Shoulders, I'm not familiar with that product. I don't have the old dandruff. Do you get that, Rob?
No, I don't, but a lot of people do, Edge, and that's one of the reasons why, with this product, which they sell a lot of, they will make a lot of money for Gotcha for Life, the Gus Wallen Foundation.
So what's the go? If you buy Head & Shoulders, they make donation to...
They would, or any Gillette product at yep. Chemist Warehouse, and they'll donate 25 cents to Gotcha for Life. So, Derek, you're a big supporter of men's mental health, mate. I'm sure this is the sort of thing that would float your blood.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's something that I think, particularly as blokes, we could be better at talking about openly in a forum like this one. And, yeah, it's a ripper course. So I think everyone should get behind it.
Absolutely. And, well, when I saw that fantastic photo of you and your mates in Albania, I thought, you know, what a great environment for the lads to spend time having some fun, but, you know, talking about serious stuff as well.
That's it, Rob. A bit of fresh air up in the mountains can clear the mind and help you sort of open up about certain things that you may not have been feeling like doing so. And I am not a Head & Shoulders man, but a Gillette man, so I'll get in there and stock up for the next 12 months, Rob, and that'll see a larger donation to the cause.
Well, listeners won't know, Rob, will they, that Willem has very, very good mushtaka, which is quite well groomed. I know he uses a bit of the Gillette product.
Yeah, well,
what about my hair? I'm in my Dutch slickback era, Edge. What do you reckon?
Well, it's not blonde. I noticed that.
Magnificent bouffant he's got going there. I mean, a real lady killer, the old Willem, representing box to box brilliantly for the young men as he is. Products start from $12.39.
Hey, did you say the beers in Albania were free?
More or less.
Yeah. How much were they?
€2.
It's a pretty good price for a beer.
Yeah. They don't sell beer at Chemist Warehouse. Maybe we should talk about that a little bit later. Or maybe one day. Products, that is the Head & Shoulders and Gillette products, start from $12.39. So make a purchase today and support a great cause. Remember, in addition to visiting your local Chemist Warehouse store, you can click and collect to save time, order online for delivery by Australia Post, or choose fast delivery for same day home delivery. T's and C's and charges may apply. Chemist Warehouse, doing great for the community and great savings every single day.
To box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box, and we're loving the Euros, early days though it is, and plenty of the big traditional football nations getting off on the front foot. But one of the nations that we've enjoyed a lot of in the last nearly two decades now, that always seem to bob up, whether it's the World Cup, the Euros, has been Croatia. And Luka Modric has been the centrepiece to pretty much every Croatian story that there has been in the past couple of decades around football. To 39 years old, he's about to turn. I guess the question is this the final big tournament for Luka Modric? Is there another season of football at the European level to look forward to in the World Cup in a couple of years' time? The man that we talk to every time a big event comes around and Croatia's involved, from Telesport and independent football writer with The Guardian, Alexander Holliger. Welcome back to Box, Alexander.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Always good to talk to you, mate. Now, I was reading your preview article of the tournament in The Guardian, and I'd recommend it to anybody, The Last Dance, Croatia, braced for the end of the Modric era. But there was a sting in the tail, because at the very end, you say don't ask him about swan songs, because he won't talk about retiring. So I guess I want to jump right into the middle of the game at hand against Spain. And before we started recording tonight, I jumped back in and watched the highlights. And as good as Spain were, unless I'm a poor judge of football, at the very worst, Croatia should have lost that game 3-1, if not 3-2, but for some excellent last-ditch defending and a penalty save. Do you subscribe to the theory that Spain were completely dominant in that match and that Croatia were better value than a lot of the pundits are giving them credit for?
Well, I wouldn't describe Spain as dominant, but I would say that they had control of the game. They were already 3-0 up at halftime. So whatever happened in the second part of the game, it was just, you can't look at it, from the same point of view as the first half. Croatia had their chances. They were dangerous when they crossed the halfway line. But I think Spain just controlled the game and wasn't that hard for them. So I wouldn't say they were dominant, because the numbers and the stats don't tell such a story. But I'm guessing if they had to put in some more attacking effort, they probably would.
So, based on what you've said, you think that they had a little petrol left in the tank if they really needed it. But let's talk about Croatia for a moment. It doesn't sound like you're writing them off ahead of the Albania match, but Albania were good against Italy. Scored after, what was it, a record 21 seconds, I think it was. Do you still give them some chance of regrouping in that match and getting out of this group, if not as one of the top two teams, then perhaps as one of the lucky third place getters?
Well, I think there's a very good chance for Croatia still to finish second in the group or third. I mean, when you compare them to the other teams in the group, I think they're still better than Italy and much better than Albania. But that doesn't have to mean everything, you know. I think the way Albania play, it could pose a problem for Croatia, especially because Croatia is usually on these big tournaments, they usually play better against the big teams. And now that wasn't the case. But I think Albania, with their quick transition and these tricky players and their really tight defense, could pose a lot of problems for Croatia, especially if Dalic isn't going to change a couple of things that he should change for this game.
What are the big changes that you would do then? You kind of teased us there. If you were in Dalic's position, what would you be doing for the Albania game?
I think what he tried to do against Spain, he tried to play the same way that Croatia did against Portugal. And Spain is a very different team from Portugal, especially given how their wingers behave. The wingers have very different roles than the ones in Portugal, and it just didn't work against Spain. So Albania can't really be compared to either of those teams. But what we saw in the game against Spain, we just saw that some of the players were just not on the required level. And I think Dalic has to decide. He has to figure it out whether it was just in this game, the specific circumstances of these games that they underperformed, or that there's a larger problem. I think almost everybody will agree that Brozovic is one of those players who just didn't play well. It wasn't the Brozovic that everybody got used to. He wasn't that tight defensively and didn't contribute much. So, but the problem is Dalic doesn't really have a proper replacement for him. And now, if he leaves Brozovic on the bench, then he will probably have to change the whole system. Which kind of, I think this was one of his backup plans to switch to 4-2-3-1 in some games. And he could do that. I think against Albania, that could be a really viable option to switch the system and perhaps play, I don't know, Kramaric as number 10 or Maier. And this could probably work better than if he just leaves things as they are. Also, we've seen some really... some problems that weren't expected on this level in defense. I think, we were quite surprised that he decided to go with Pongratic in defense because he traveled to the US as almost like an outsider. He was far from a starting role. But when you take a look at the options that he has, he was probably his best option to go with him and Sutala. But both of them underperformed in that match, especially Pongratic. And I think after this game, he also might be losing his starting position. But, you know, that are just two examples. I think it's difficult for us to evaluate. We could have some, I don't know, propositions for what could be changed, but Dalic probably knows. I mean, he surely knows better if some of the stuff that we saw against Spain were just specific to that game, or some of the players are having problems in general.
One of the players that could move into the middle of defence is obviously Manchester City's Gvardiol. He's obviously come off an amazing season with the English champions, not just in defence, but he scored some pretty important and impressive goals. Is he the sort of player that could slot in and shore them up in the middle of defence? And just generally, you know, we've mentioned Modric off the top. Is this the sort of player that Croatia can build the next generation around, given his age and how important he's going to be?
Well, I think it's only obvious that Gvardiol is now, I would say, the only Croatia player that is playing on really elite world-class level. And he's the best Croatia player at the moment. The problem with him in the context of the Croatian national team is that his role at Manchester City can't be replicated in the national team, because in Manchester City he plays a somewhat hybrid role. It's something between a centre-back and a full-back. And even even if in those things that he does as left back at City, these things are different than what he's required to do for Croatia. So while he's probably Croatia's best option for left back, I don't think he's as good playing that as he would be in central defense. So Dalic has decided ahead of the tournament that he's going to use him as left back, especially in the game against Spain and probably in the game against Italy. He didn't say anything about the Albania game, so we might see Guardiola moving back to center back, if only just for this game. And having Sosa playing left back would be a much more attacking option. We could see that against Albania.
Croatia in previous tournaments have always been described as a dark horse, or often described, you know, often called that by commentators. They're not a dark horse anymore because they've reached the, you know, major world finals. Do you think they're better as a dark horse?
Yeah, definitely. Croatians love to be dark horses. They love to be, you know, underestimated. They love to be a challenge to show their best. But somehow, I think just the whole feeling ahead of this Spain game was different from before. I think, it looked to me, Croatia weren't really favorites against Spain, obviously. Spain were favorites in that game, but usually the feeling was much different than this time. I think this time Croatia... I'm talking about general public, not just the team, the coaches and the players. They approach this as if they're, you know, like a really big team who is playing another big team in a big tournament. And it was, I wouldn't say it was relaxed, but it wasn't, I didn't feel the same passion in their approach as is in some previous tournaments, you know. I didn't feel that desire to prove themselves because they probably thought they have already proven themselves and now they're among the big boys. They are one of them, you know. And so this is not a good position for Croatia to be in. Croatia is much more well off when they're considered outsiders or dark horses and, you know, something that they can say, nobody believes in us, but we believe in ourselves. So this is the kind of motivation that really works for them.
Given that that's not the case anymore, Alexander, you know, Croatia are not ranked 10 in the world for no good reason, as you and Derek have just discussed. Albania, 66th in the world. Admittedly, we know that FIFA rankings only mean so much when it comes to these big tournaments. Teams lift an incredible atmosphere from the travelling fans in the stadium. You face them in the next round. Let's assume that for Croatia to progress, they have to get the 3 points in that game. And we leap forward to Italy, ranked just one above Croatia, and their own wobbly experiences in recent big tournaments, not making the past two World Cups, but dovetailed with the win in the last Euros. I get back to the Modric discussion at the very beginning. Is he capable of still being as influential as we know him at his best? Dalic says he wants him on the park all the time, as opposed to the occasional use that he gets with Real Madrid. Are your expectation and the expectations of the Croatian people that will happen, that Croatia will beat Albania and get a point, a result out of the Italy match and progress and get better throughout the tournament? Or on the flip side, if that doesn't happen, what will the reaction be at home?
Well, I do believe that they will beat Albania. If they don't, that's basically the end of the tournament for Croatia. Even if they had some chance in theory left, they would just probably fall apart in the last game, and that would be it. If they don't beat Albania, that's it for Croatia, I believe. But, you know, Croatia is a huge favorite against Albania. This defeat in the first round might even do them good for them to, you know, I don't know, to try with some kind of different approach now that they have to win. Usually when they have to win, it's a good position and good motivation for them. They're usually good when they have to be. So, well, I don't know. As for Modric, you know, well, he's not getting any younger, and I think this finally shows on the pitch. For a long time, he was able to surprise everybody with his amazing performances, even as he got older. But now, it was, I think, only obvious on the pitch that he just can't do it anymore on that level. He might still bounce back in some games, and I was—I have to say—I was positively surprised with Dalic taking him off in the game against Spain. I thought he was going to keep him, you know, for full 90 minutes, regardless of the result. But you know, I think Dalic just conceded the defeat and thought it was best to save Modric for the rest of the games.
Okay, and the reaction at home if Croatia don't progress, have they got enough points in the bank from the successes of recent times that they might get off the hook, or is the reaction likely to be a lot more negative than that?
Well, no, there are mixed reactions. There are obviously people who think it was just a bad day, which I don't think it was. I think it revealed some of the larger issues. But, you know, it's only a first game of the tournament, and we'll see. With a good performance in the second game, you know, everything can, you know, turn around. But it's a rather tricky fixture now for Croatia. It might even be better for them if they played Italy right now rather than Albania, because Albania is the sort of team that you know, they thrive from chaos, which is something that Croatia used to be really good at. And they also have a really tight defense. And you know, against those teams, it's very easy to concede a goal from almost nowhere, from nothing. And then you're in real trouble. And Croatia right now are having just as many problems in attack as they are defensively, I would say. So if they concede a goal against Albania, they will it will be really difficult for them. They will probably start panicking, and no one knows what would happen now.
It's such an intriguing narrative, Alexander. As we have this conversation, will we be asking you in 2 weeks' time to come back and talk to us about a final matchup deep into the tournament, or will we be trawling over the entrails of a campaign that saw the end of a once great team? We don't know that yet. We're about to find out. We love seeing Croatia do well, as you know, what used to be a dark horse and underdog no longer. But hopefully for Croatia, you do get through, and we continue the conversation, you know, later in the tournament, mate. Good luck, Alexander, and thanks again for coming on Box to Box.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
No problems, Alexander Holliger from Croatia, authority on Croatian football. And if you haven't read the Guardian previews of the tournament, I know we're a week in, not quite a week in, but check out Alexander's articles on Croatia, as well as his pen portrait on the team ahead of the event. Okay, stick around. World Cup Corner next on Box to Box.
Willa, 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 everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
Willem, you must have eaten some flavour-packed meals in Albania.
Most certainly, Rob. And now we've rolled on to Dusseldorf, and we're first night in town, and my mate and I walked past the traditional German feeding court. Yeah, okay, the pork knuckle, the sauerkraut, the dumpling, and the mashed potato. It is absolute heaven over here. So, flavour-packed. They probably don't need Hoyts, but they are on an island in that regard, Rob, because everyone else does.
No, absolutely. I mean, they look, sometimes the subtle flavours of spices do permeate these great foods. I mean, you know, you don't use any old salt and pepper. You've got to put a little bit of love into it and make sure that that you use the best. Now, I'm going to come from a Middle Eastern angle here because, you know, I'm not in Albania. I'm not in Bangkok, Mexico City, LA, or even the Healesville Sanctuary. But I made some fantastic barbecue double cut lamb cutlets, right? Crushed the garlic in some salt. And then I got my Hoyt's mixed spices, which, as we all know, you've listened to it plenty. I talk about it often. Coriander, ginger, nutmeg, ground cassia bark and cloves, olive oil, and then barbecue the lamb cutlets. Just enough to make them pink inside. And some hummus, baba ganoush, fattoush, fantastic Middle Eastern salad with a garlicky, lemony olive oil salad and some Lebanese bread. That is a meal for a king, Edge.
Well, over here in Bangkok, lamb's very expensive, so I don't get to experience the lamb cutlets that you obviously eat fairly regularly back in Australia. So I'm not happy with you explaining that because it sounds so good, but I can't just walk out the front door and grab it.
No, I'm sorry, mate, but they were bloody good. But they're expensive, so you can't have them all the time. When you have them, you want them to
lamb
taste.
Lamb is expensive these days, isn't it?
It is a little bit, but I mean, Derek, he could just go out in the backyard and
slaughter his own lamb.
Yeah, you'd have plenty out there, wouldn't you, Derek?
I drove past a whole field of sheep and lamb this morning, so yeah, I could probably get my hands on one.
Did you do some Homer Simpson type thought bubbles of just sort of leaping over the fence and gnawing on one?
I was thinking maybe it's probably quite an illegal thing to do, so that any local farmers who listen to our show, don't worry, I won't really be doing that. So, maybe alpaca meat in the future.
Oh, yes, well, valet to your poor old alpaca who did pass away not too long ago. Remember, refill your empty spice jars with Hoyt's value packs. You'll be happy with Hoyt's at Coles, Woolworths, and all good independent supermarkets.
Fill those empties with Hoyt's spices, yeah. Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Great listening to Alexander. We met him before the Russian World Cup, Edge, when you and Willem were over there. And I can't even remember how we found him, but he travelled through that World Cup and talked to us regularly up at 2 and including that final. So, you know, I've just got a soft spot for them, I think maybe just because of Alexander. So I hope they do get out of this group. Anyway, it's World Cup corner time. Now, Derek, you toss something into our chat. We're always sort of bantering about what topics we'll bring up. Sometimes it's really obvious and other times it's a bit of a challenge. But this is a proper World Cup story that you're bringing to the table from the Singaporean goalkeeper. Tell us more.
Yes, we're going to Edge's part of the world, and this does involve Thailand, so we'll get his view on it in the moment. But this is the story that the Singapore goalkeeper, whose name is Hassan Sunny, and he's 40 years old. He was involved in a loss to Thailand, a 3-1 loss in a crucial World Cup qualifier. But Hassan Sunny made 11 saves, denying the Thais more goals in the game. And as a result, China managed to squeak through on goal difference into the next round of qualifying because of this amazing shot stopping from the 40-year-old. What's ended up happening is Chinese fans have found out more about Hassan Sunny. They found out that he is a storekeeper. He has a market stall. He has some kind of retail business, and people are using a QR code to send him money to thank him for his exploits against Thailand. He's actually called now for people to stop sending him money because it's getting embarrassing. At the start, he thought it was funny. It was okay for a while, but then he says, "When is this going to stop? Is this even legal? Should people be paying him? You know, it has to stop somewhere." So what he said is he appreciates the support of the past few days. But, you know, the QR code for payments at my coconut rice stall has been widely circulated online. Some videos have even been edited with a fake QR code. So someone else is receiving the money, therefore have got to ask people to stop. So This can only happen in this part of the world, Ed, surely. And obviously China has a big link to Singapore. But, what do you make of all this?
Well, just for they're not sending any money in his bank account. They're sending yuan cash in the mail. That's what they're doing. So he keeps going to his splitter box every day and getting wads of cash in the mail. So it is quite funny. But there's another sort of story to that is that Thailand, Madam Pang, who is the first female president of any Asian Football Confederation nation, she was involved in the local league here, and there's, you know, the situation in Thailand was they lost to China at home. When that happened, it appears the royal family said enough is enough, and they cleared out the federation and they cleared the way for Madam Pang to take over. And they didn't lose another game in qualification, Thailand, but they needed to beat China by 3 goals in their final game to go through to the next phase of qualification. And it was one of those games that, you know, they hit the bar 3 times. They could have easily won 7 or 8 nil, and the goalkeeper from Singapore had a wonderful game. But the big thing that's not really covered in the media is Madam Pang, who's an incredibly successful corporate leader here in Thailand. Her family owns and runs the biggest insurance company here. She was on the sidelines as the Thailand men's players were leaving the field. And talk about a death stare. She wasn't blaming the coach. She was absolutely zeroing in on every single one of those Thai players who left the field. She was not happy. And I'm expecting big things from the Thai Federation in the next phase. But, yeah, hugely disappointing for Thailand. I know there's a bit of a funny story out of this, but geez, I would have preferred China in the next phase of qualification. Thailand rather than China, Derek, wouldn't you?
Oh, look, I'm not political on this part. But I know that you're passionate about Thailand, and you know, just unfortunate for Singapore that they weren't getting through. Just to close this story off, the shop where the goalkeeper works specializes in a meal called nasi lemak, which is a rice dish cooked in coconut milk and pandan leaves served with fried chicken. No doubt he would need that. He may or may not need Hoyt's herbs and spices. So maybe we can link Hassan up with Hoyt's.
Oh, well, Johnny Accardo is one of the most generous people I know. I'm sure be happy to help help our man Hassan Sunny to get all of his spices for that nasi lemak, which is a great dish, by the way, in case you've never had it. And by the way, I've just been playing around online, Edge. I've heard you mention Madam Pang a few times over the various episodes, and I up until now I haven't done a search on her. I mean, it sort of makes it feel like she's some old lady. She's not. She's a 58-year-old former Boston University graduate.
That's right. She's as I said, she's a corporate icon here in Thailand. Mm. And all power to her too, because we love Thai football.
Yes, none more than you. Now, Willem, you got one to leave us with?
Yeah, one to leave us with. And just quickly, I just cannot get my head around the fact that having cash sent to your letterbox is an issue. But anyway, that's one for the goalkeeper. Some celebration this week for Kevin O'Neill, Socceroo number 113. He is now a recipient of the Medal of the Order of Australia for his services to the game. 512 first grade appearances in the Northern New South Wales leagues and 26 games, or official A games for Australia, as well as a number of other tests. 4 of those as captain from the late 40s to the late 60s. So a long career. Big congratulations to Kevin, recognised for his services to Australian football.
Yeah, well said. Nice one to wrap it up, mate. And I just want to ask you quickly, speaking of questions without notice, Edge, Willem asked me one earlier in the show. The FIFA rankings, Edge, how do the USA sit just outside of the top 10 above Colombia, Morocco, Mexico, Uruguay, Germany, Senegal, Japan, Switzerland? How does that work?
Because they dominate CONCACAF, you know, and that's the reality. They've had some incredible results in CONCACAF. They're the reigning Gold Cup winners as well. So, you know, the ranking, I don't want to go into detail about explaining the ranking points, but they are ranked based on success at regional confederations and international tournaments. So USA continue to dominate. That's what it is. And it's one of the quirks of the system. It's why I don't take them seriously.
Yeah, no. Well said. That's what I was thinking as you said it. All right, well, gentlemen, I'm going to take a seat on the bench for stoppage time. I'll sit back and enjoy that later in the week when you guys put it together. Willem, good to have you back, mate.
Great to be back. Thank you, gents. Enjoy your football.
We'll plenty of it. Yeah, I'll be looking forward to talk to you next week. You'll have had at least one game under your belt by then, won't you?
The great Scotland turnaround.
Yes.
Steve Clark masterclass.
Will that happen, Derek?
Yeah, I hope so. We'll talk about it in stoppage time, which I think will get people's podcast catches a little earlier this week as we try and keep pace with the amount of games that are going on. And I dare say, Rob, there might be a film reference in there once again.
All right. Well, I will definitely be enjoying listening to that. Edge, good to chat, mate, and get down and have some nasi lemak. Fine. I know you're not in Singapore, mate, but they'd have a good one in Thailand.
Next time I'm in Singapore, I'll do that. But no, I think I might just stick to a little bit of Tom Yum Goom tonight.
Ooh, nice soup. Like that. Adam Maloney, thank you for pulling this all together and editing, producing as you always do, mate. Brilliant stuff. And to you, our listeners, thank you again for tuning in. If you have a moment and you haven't already, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your favourite shows, and make sure you subscribe to Box, Stoppage Time and Offside. Tweet us at BoxToBoxNTS and follow us on X. Make sure you like us on Facebook as well. And join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.